the disease and not your immune system. Otherwise, you can use ginger, which is great for everything. It's what I'm drinking right now, actually. Golden Seal, Padiaco, Slippery Elm, and Yarrow teas are all really good for boosting the immune system and fighting viral infections as well as bacterial and other infections. So it is 4 p.m. We are asking you to stay tuned for Solidarity Not Charity, the talk show of white solidarity with the Uhuru movement, with Black Power. This is Iyapo Wangina Bendele, and I want to say all power to the people, Black Power to the African community. Uhuru.
Uhuru, and welcome to Solidarity Not Charity, the weekly program of the African People's Solidarity Committee. Apologize for a couple of moments of dead air there. We had a technical issue in the studio. Welcome to Solidarity Not Charity, the weekly program of the African People's Solidarity Committee. We want to thank, as always, with the most profound thanks and appreciation to the African People's Socialist Party for its tremendous leadership and vision and strategy and just ass-kicking work on the ground, fighting for liberation of African people, for the putting an end to the terrible parasitic system of U.S. imperialist domination of the world's peoples. We want to thank the party for its forming way back in 1976 of the African People's Solidarity Committee as part of its strategy to win freedom for African people and people around the world and to bring into being a new era of human society where there would be no bosses and workers, no slaves and slave masters, no exploitation and parasitic relationship of one people over another. And as a part of that strategy, form the African People's Solidarity Committee to allow white people wherever we are located in the world to play our role in overturning this system and to raise resources, to raise political support under the leadership of the African Revolution. So we want to really, really thank the party for their leadership in that. And, of course, to thank the party for the weekly program that we have here on UhuruRadio.com, the online voice of the International African Revolution. This week, on yesterday, we had up in Philadelphia, I want to start off the program by giving a shout out to everyone who attended the national conference of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement, which is an organization that was established by the African People's Solidarity Committee to do work on the ground, to make a place for anybody in the white community, for any ally of the African liberation struggle to be able to become, participate at any level in supporting the struggle of African people and of African liberation, whether you are a card-carrying member paying your annual dues, whether you are a down-and-dirty activist just out there every week coming to committee meetings, going to help out on the various fundraisers that we're doing, organizing campus events, doing outreach, organizing participation from the white community in demonstrations, defending the democratic rights of the African community. Anything you want to do, there's a place for you in the Hoorah Solidarity Movement. And even if you are in some remote area, maybe you're the only person in your whole town who believes in African liberation and wants to take a stand of principled solidarity with the African liberation movement, there's ways that you can participate and ways that you can support from anywhere you are. So contact us if you're out there and you have not been in direct touch with the African People's Solidarity Committee or the Uhuru Solidarity Movement. Go online to uhurusolidarity.org. Our phone numbers are there, our emails are there, and you can get a hold of us. We encourage you to get involved. And for those people who were fortunate enough to be in Philadelphia this weekend, just want to give a congratulations and a shout-out. I understand there was a fantastic conference, the national conference that took place on yesterday. And for those of us who missed that conference, including myself, who were not able to be in Philadelphia on yesterday, we have a treat for you. Today we're going to air the presentation, the opening presentation that was made by African People's Solidarity Committee Chairwoman Penny Hess. And for those of you who were there and were like, that was so awesome, I want to hear that again, now's your chance. We're going to air that presentation right now. Here is African People's Solidarity Committee Chairwoman Penny Hess.
And Ali for that great introduction to this conference. I want to join in welcoming everybody here today to this discussion and meeting that we're going to have. I want to unite with everything that's been put out, and I know that we're going to have a really excellent program and something that we can all learn and deepen our understandings about. I want to join in welcoming Chairman Omali Yeshitela, Arana Fofoma, Diako Lubala, Ona Zene Yeshitela, the members of the African People's Socialist Party. We're very honored to have them here today with us to be able to participate in this conference. So I just want to start out by saying, you know, again, as has been said, I'm a member of the African People's Solidarity Committee. This is the organization that leads the Uhuru Solidarity Movement overall. We are a white organization formed by the African People's Socialist Party. We work under their leadership. We work in the white communities to organize other white people and other people who can be allies of the African liberation movement. Now, about 2 weeks ago here in Philadelphia was the Uhuru Solidarity Movement sponsored Earth Day, and maybe some of the people here participated in that. It was kind of a flea market, and it was on, I guess, the Earth Day weekend. We had about 2,000 people at that. And, of course, what we were trying to say at Earth Day is that we wanted to make a connection to, you know, with the whole question of the environment and the environmental issue to the struggle of African people and oppressed people on this planet for liberation. And that was something we wanted to make that connection. We wanted people to understand something about what the Uhuru movement is about and what it is doing to transform and change this world. So, you know, we welcome the people who are here today because we want to deepen this question. We want to talk about this morning. I'm going to talk about the environmental question, but I want to talk about it as a critique. I mean, it's certainly in the Uhuru movement, and I think everybody who's rational believes that the Earth is in a crisis and it must be protected and must be, you know, saved for the generations of people who come after us. But how is that done, and how is that question approached? And that's what we want to talk about and go into. So I'm going to start with a PowerPoint or a slideshow.
We're listening to African People's Solidarity Committee Chairwoman Penny Hess.
Just to start, environmental justice through African liberation. And again, the understandings in this presentation come from Chairman Omali Yeshitela and the political understandings of African internationalism that leads the Uhuru movement. And this is the point of view of the African working class and oppressed peoples around the world. And we can look at the world today and see that there's a tremendous crisis on the planet. We see U.S. wars, we see the Obama administration promised to end the war against the Iraqi people, but we know that there's still going to be at least 50,000 U.S. soldiers in Iraq. We know that the U.S. is escalating in Afghanistan, escalating the war against Pakistan and on the border there, and that, you know, there's really, a geopolitical strategy of the Obama administration that is pretty much a continuation of the Bush administration, except that maybe it's focused more on Afghanistan and Pakistan. And so we see these wars of plunder, wars of military occupation, wars against colonized peoples around the world, and we see tremendous famine, starvation, drought, afflicting, you know, peoples of the world. We know in Africa, at least 50% of the population lives on less than a dollar a day, and around the world, about half of the 6.7 billion people live in dire poverty. We're seeing in the United States almost every day crisis at the workplace, or people going into work, or their families, or other places, and starting shooting people and killing people. It's like you can almost read this every single day, this crisis. And it's a manifestation of the crisis that we see in this country and around the world. And we also understand that this system, capitalism, was built, it was formed on the enslavement of African people, the genocide against the indigenous people, and colonialism around the world. And colonialism means an imperial power goes in and steals the resources and the labor of other peoples for the benefit of the U.S. and Europe. We know that there's oppressed and colonized peoples inside the United States. We know that it's no coincidence, or it's not chance, that half of the 7.5 million people in this country tied to the prison system right now, at least 51% of them are African. Another third of them are indigenous or Mexican people. And, you know, this is the reality right here. And yet it is so little questioned or even discussed. And we also know that for everybody that reads the paper or that listens to the news, we know that we're in the worst capitalist economic crisis in this century, well, certainly in a century, here inside the United States. We see bankers, even from the Obama administration, who said that he was going to make changes, bankers getting bailed out with, so far pledged by the United States government with taxpayers' money, $13.5 trillion to shore up the banks, the CEOs, Wall Street, while African communities bear the brunt of economic crisis. This is something, again, that is not discussed on MSNBC or even as part of the economic crisis that exists, but if you go to a city like Detroit or Cleveland, cities that are 80-85% African, it's like something from a movie, a sci-fi movie of the future, with empty skyscrapers, nobody on the streets, and whole sections of neighborhoods in the African community boarded up, empty, falling down, stripped of every valuable resource, plywood, copper, piece, you know, PVP, whatever. Just an incredible poverty that exists. They're saying that in Detroit right now, that the median house price or home price is $7,000. That's how impoverished or the deep economic crisis that it's in. And for the white population, we're seeing people experience economic and political insecurity for the first time ever. Around the world, we're seeing growing resistance of African and oppressed peoples, and I think, as Ali said, the Uhuru movement is building the African Socialist International, an organization of African people all over the world that is working to unite African people in Africa with African people wherever they have been dispersed around the world to liberate Africa for the benefit of African people. And this is the context of the crisis of the environment. Because to put it in any other context would be a serious error. So just to give a little bit of history, for tens of thousands of years, African and indigenous people were the custodians of the planet. And you look at ancient Africa, and monuments were built for all the ages, not like we have, you know, a building that might last 25 years before it falls down, but monuments that attest to the longevity of humanity and longevity of the earth. That when King Tut was alive, I think about 1500 BC, the Great Sphinx was already between 5 and maybe 8,000 years old. So even to him, to look at it, it was something so ancient that, you know, it was awe-inspiring to understand. We know that in African and indigenous cultures, decisions by leaders were made understanding that this decision had to affect positively at least 7 generations into the future. Can you imagine the leaders of the United States making decisions based on anything like that? Also, in ancient societies, there was no concept of private property. There is a statement, a famous statement by the indigenous leader, Tecumseh, who said, sell a country. Why not sell the air, the great sea, as well as the earth? Of course, all of that is up for sale now. But to the indigenous and African people, there was no concept of land, of private property. So when Europeans came to New York and said, oh, here, we'll give you some beads for Manhattan, there was no idea that they were selling that land. It was, well, yeah, we can share this. And that was the understanding that people around the world had. The people and the environment were one. The Aztecs in the Middle Ages grew their gardens on a lake. They had something like 250 varieties of potatoes. When Europeans came, they just stole one or two varieties that wouldn't survive a drought. But the Aztecs had potatoes that would grow in a drought, in a freezing cold winter, in every kind of physical situation. And you know, they made these like baskets and floated them onto the lake and grew their plants out on the lake. In fact, they actually had the city, Tenochtitlan, which is now where Mexico City is, was eventually built and floated onto that lake. And when the conquistadors came, they said it was the most beautiful place that they had ever seen. I'm talking about the Spanish invaders that came into the Americas and stole the land. And what did they do? They didn't live in peace with the Aztec people. They immediately came in and began slaughtering the indigenous people and destroying their civilization. In fact, Mexico City was built on this lake. It's really interesting because they drained the lake. And now Mexico City, besides being supposedly the center of the swine flu, has a serious water shortage. They turn off the water there because of the public water for up to 36 hours at a time. Which 20 million Aztecs lived in the region and never had any problem with water. So, you know, again, this is part of parasitic capitalism. We see rice farming in Asia, a very collective way of farming that has gone on for thousands and thousands of years. And we can see that there was a way. When we say that there's the ability in the future for there to be an economy and a society that is in a positive relationship with the environment, it happened. It already was like that for thousands of years. It's not something that really has to be reinvented. It already was, and it had these qualities. And there was an amicable sense of trade routes that actually went all throughout the world, all from Mali and Zimbabwe and southern Africa, all the way up to northern Africa, across the Arab world, into Asia, India, and China, and even to the Americas by ship, the Olmec heads, and there's all kinds of proof of that. And so we saw prosperity for whole societies inside of a sustainable economy. There was little or non-existent state. There was no prisons in indigenous and African societies. There weren't communities that were demonstrating against police brutality. There wasn't the need for public housing. There wasn't the institutions of the state that are institutions of coercion and violence against the people to protect the property and the wealth of a ruling class. It wasn't a society in that way. It was a collective society shared by all, in which all of the benefits of the food and, you know, the land went to all of the people. So a healthy environment, which was a natural part of these conditions. But all of this changed with European invasion of the rest of the world. Europe in the Middle Ages was poor, it was plague-ridden, it was isolated from the rest of the world. And in 1340s and 1350s, about maybe up to a half of the population of Europe was killed through the plague. And its economy was in a very deep crisis. It was under a system called feudalism, in which there were lords and ladies, maybe very, very few of them, and most of Europeans were serfs, near slaves, tied to the land that just farmed all year, gave most of the farm crops to the lords and to the ladies. And as Europe went into Africa and to the Americas, there was incredible resistance. The people fought back for many, many years. But we saw in Africa once free people, people who had lived and had great civilizations in Africa for tens of thousands of years, were now chained, were now enslaved and conquered with guns, with gunpowder. And African people became Europe's most lucrative commodity. And in a system that would build itself on human beings, could have no possible regard for the environment. We see that in the Americas, there was the theft of the indigenous land, the Trail of Tears, just open genocide against the indigenous people, killing probably 300 million in this hemisphere. It's not true what is said that the whole land was empty, because especially the eastern seaboard was very, very populated, and most of the time when Europeans came into this, what became the United States, they took over the land and farms and farm areas of the indigenous people and just moved them out and took it over. We see by 1890, Wounded Knee, this is an actual photogram of the genocide against the indigenous people at Wounded Knee that was carried out by the U.S. cavalry and voluntary militias, volunteer cavalry. They slaughtered the people in the Lakota Sioux in December. They just left them in the snow, dead and frozen, and came back in the spring and dug mass graves and began throwing the people into the mass graves. And in this process, buffalo herds were wiped out. Salmon was fished for profit, and now I'm reading that almost all ocean fish could be extinct in our lifetime. And African people were forced to labor for white man's profit. And cotton, which was the main crop that enslaved Africans were forced to labor for free, destroyed the topsoil all over the United States. And you know, with this kind of of capitalist system, it was just like, use resources, use land, move on, there's so much more. You know, it was destroy, destroy, destroy. And it's a byproduct of enslaving human beings and committing genocide against the indigenous people and a system of colonialism. So in Africa and Congo, we see that there was genocide against, for example, the people of Congo who were forced to harvest rubber in the rainforest and by the Belgians to, you know, to provide resources for the growing car and bicycle industry in the 1890s and the early 1900s. People were enslaved, and up to 10 million or more Africans were slaughtered, absolute genocide, by the Belgians in Congo in this period. No outcry any place around the world about that. And Africans that weren't killed, their hands were cut off. This is actual photographs. Their hands were cut off as a way to intimidate their whole families. Often it was children. They say there were mountains of hands. And in this process, today, 90% of West Africa's rainforests have been destroyed. And African people lived there for thousands and thousands of years. But this is since the invasion of Europeans. Millions of African people were killed in the colonial ivory trade for piano keys and billiard balls. They were forced to carry the ivory tusks halfway across Africa, just working until death, just worked to death. And at least 2 million Africans were killed in that process. And African elephants are now nearly extinct. African and indigenous people were enslaved in gold and silver mines all throughout Africa. All of those resources still stolen today, diamonds, gold, silver, uranium, all of that stolen from Africa today. And parasitic mining destroyed the land and water in southern Africa. This is an actual Google map picture of a mining area of southern Africa and the destruction that exists there. So slavery and genocide created capitalism, the Industrial Revolution, that polluted the air and made Europe wealthy and powerful for the first time in its history. And it gave opportunities for prosperity, property, jobs to millions of white people who came from Europe to the Americas at the expense of African and indigenous people. So white people could come up the ladder of success in the United States by stepping on the backs of African and indigenous people in this country. And this is the same system that polluted the earth. This is how it got polluted. And we see hunting and killing of African people became white people's sport. Killing of animals for sport, an outgrowth of colonial terror. We see colonized peoples imprisoned by the millions. We see zoos as an outgrowth of colonialism. For example, Odabenga, an African from the Congo, was kidnapped from the Congo and in 1906 was in the Bronx Zoo. And that wasn't unusual. Ishi in California, the last of the Pueblo Indians, was kept in the Museum of Anthropology of San Francisco as an exhibit. That happened all over the world. So the problem that we see is not racism. It is not environmentalism separate from this whole reality. And it's not racism. It is colonialism. It doesn't really help anybody for white people to take courses on unlearning racism. All it does is make us feel better, but it doesn't change any of the conditions that exist. It doesn't change the war against the African community going on right now. It doesn't change anything. And so what the Uhuru movement calls on is for white people to be organized under the leadership of the Movement for Liberation for African People. And that is what can change the world. That makes a very concrete situation where we can go into the white communities and organize white people to take a stand in solidarity with the actual movement that's struggling for liberation. And that we live in a society living that creates this consumer-driven, growth-based society at the expense of oppressed people. We live in a country where consumer spending is 75% of the gross domestic product today. And that needs ongoing plunder of human and natural resources to survive. There's no way a society like that, that's based on consumerism, based on growth, based on parasitism, can happily have, you know, a relationship with the environment that's healthy or solve the problem. Because this is what created it. This system can't solve it. America's lifestyle is an unsustainable price of suffering, of genocide, of rape, of human beings and the earth inside this country and around the world. And that parasitic capitalism is the reason for economic and environmental collapse that we see today. So some environmentalists say, well, the problem is overpopulation. And of course, they're talking about in colonized countries, right? But the reality is the United States is 5% of the world's population, but uses 50% of the world's resources. So that means 300 million Americans use the resources of 3.4 billion people. So where's the problem of population? We talk about this brutality that it takes against the African community for the society to exist every single day. Well, from about the 1860s to about the 1940s, there was a system, mostly in the South, in the southern states, that was called convict leasing. It was after the Civil War, after African people were supposedly free, quote-unquote, in this country, when actually the real terror began. And convict leasing was now where the states, the individual states throughout the South, now owned Africans and leased them out. They did that by instituting Jim Crow laws and making almost everything African people did illegal. There was nothing they could do to raise a family, feed their families and their children. It all became illegal, to even farm, to have a boat in some cases. Anything that Africans were successful at, they were driven out, either through individual white terror or through decisions and laws of these states that made it illegal for them to do that. So that hundreds of thousands of Africans were arrested on these Jim Crow laws, kept in work camps throughout the South, worked to death, again, faster than during the time of enslavement, because there was no property owner, plantation owner who owned Africans as property now. They could just rent an African. So their slogan was, one die gets another. But this was such an important economic stimulus for the southern states that it rebuilt the wealth of the South after the Civil War. And in places like Alabama, convict leasing was 73% of the state's revenues in like 1890, 1891, at the expense of African people. And part of what the leased Africans, and John talking about children, elderly people, women, worked to death in these all different kinds of situations, on plantations, in the mines. And one of the famous cases that they talk about that really destroyed the environment was the phosphate mining of Alabama, Georgia, and Florida. And phosphate mining turns the landscape and has into barren, toxic land. And African children were sent down in the mines and worked to death. You know, that. So again, it's the byproduct of colonialism and slavery. The gold rush of California in the 1840s and 1850s. It was the foundation of the enormous wealth that California experiences today. But the gold rush, did you know this was state-supported genocide against indigenous people, that the state of California paid $1 million a year? $1 million, think how much that would be worth now, that we're talking about, to white people, to bring in scalps. They paid them a bounty to bring in scalps of the indigenous people during those years, to wipe them out so that the Sierras and Northern California could belong to white people. And after that, there were barely any indigenous people left. And the gold rush polluted Northern California's waters with all the mining of gold and using of mercury and heavy metals and doing that, that are still in the water of the bay and all kinds of other lakes in the area. So the question of the environmental movement was save the stolen land, remove the indigenous people. That's what it was, a white people's movement to do that, starting with Theodore Roosevelt, who was an imperialist, who responsible for genocide against the people of the Philippines. John Muir, do people know who that is? He started the Sierra Club, and there's like whole mountains and parks and stuff named after him. But Muir said, Indians are mostly ugly and have no right place in the landscape. He was essential in removing and participating in and fomenting the genocide against the indigenous people so that Yosemite could belong to the white people as a park and a place to go for vacation. Edward Abbey, do people know him? He wrote a book called The Monkey Wrench Gang, and he inspired the actions of the more militant environmental groups like Earth First, Earth Liberation Front. He said, I do not wish to live in a society dominated by blacks, Mexicans, and so-called Orientals. 5 million have been killed in the Congo by imperialist-backed forces since 1998 to control coltan, the mineral that is needed to conduct electricity in cell phones and computers. So something like 85% of the world's supply of coltan is in Congo, and many, many other resources as well. So this is why the U.S. and Europe and corporate international powers have set up proxy wars and armies to go into Congo to preserve those resources for the benefit of the imperialist powers. Coltan mining uses enslaved, colonized child labor, and it leaves toxic, depleted land. How can the Sierra Club initiate special fences around prisons to keep birds from being electrocuted? This is something that I think that they put on a ballot initiative in California in the 90s, and the state of California has spent maybe $10, $15 million on these fences that don't let the birds get electrocuted. But the Sierra Club takes no stand against the mass imprisonment of millions of African and Mexican people. They don't talk about what those prisons are doing that really work as economic stimulus for California, for the white population, at the expense of Africans and Mexicans. And that the African community lives in poverty, martial law, Jim Crow, wherever it is located. Many in the Sierra Club supported Prop 187 in California, which was the anti-immigrant law on the ballot. But Southwest Mexico was stolen, Southwest United States was stolen from Mexico right after, in fact, right during the gold rush. As soon as the U.S. saw that there was gold in those hills, they declared war on Mexico and stole 5 or 7 states from Mexico, which is now the southwest of the United States. Indigenous reservations today, the most impoverished places in the U.S., with concentration camps where the life expectancy is about 47 years. Toxic uranium mining is on the indigenous reservations. This is where it happens. And the people are dying of cancer. We see toxic waste banned in the United States or dumped in Africa, banned by environmentalists. IMF policies create drought by forcing monoculture in Africa. U.S. corporations steal oil, starve the people, and destroy the land. And they call the colonized people the pirates. It's the U.S. and Europe that are stealing the land and the resources. The African people are fighting for their land and resources. And they brought back a 15-year-old. They put him on trial, just as they do to most African 15-year-olds and 25-year-olds in this country. Lock them up for life. 3 strikes, you're out. So in Berkeley and other places, we have environmentalists sitting in trees to protect a tree, and certainly trees should be protected. But right next door in Oakland are police murders and violence against the African community. In the 1980s, Livermore Action Group was an environmentalist group in the Bay Area of Oakland. And they won an injunction after they had a big action, a civil disobedience, and they were put in Camp Parks, which was a deserted military base in Alameda County, which is where Oakland and Berkeley are. They won an injunction because there had been nuclear radioactive testing that went on there, and it was still very toxic. So they didn't get put there. But then the city of Oakland decided that it was going to put the mainly African community homeless population out in Camp Parks. And the Uhuru movement took a very strong stand and actually prevented that from happening. But did the environmentalists stand with the Uhuru movement? Of course not. In fact, they said they would only maybe stand with us if the Uhuru movement, African-led Uhuru movement, took a course led by them on nonviolence training. So how can we demand nonviolent action, yet take no stand against state violence against the African community that comes down every day? And I say that because a lot of times there are a lot of people, you know, in the left, in the environmental movement, who are talking about nonviolent action, setting the terms for that. But where, you know, if you're serious, there should be nonstop demonstrations at every police station in this country, certainly in Philadelphia. How many African people were killed by the police last year? About 25 or 30 or more? So the state is an instrument of violence and coercion. It exists when a society has been riven into classes, when it has been split, and the state is an instrument, a tool of violence to protect the wealth and power of the system built on slavery and genocide and of the ruling class. African and Mexican communities are under constant colonial state terror. We see the enforced poverty, we see the courts, the subprime mortgage targeting, which has left so many African communities in deep foreclosure for homeowners. We see the schools, which are not about learning, they're about sending African children to prison. We see sentencing, discriminatory policies. We see prisons and police. These are the forms of the state as it is used against the African and colonized people inside this country and around the world. And oppressed people have a right to resist state terror. In Oakland, a couple of weeks ago, or about a month ago, an African man killed four police. And the Uhuru movement took a stand in defense of that, in defense of that man. And we have to understand that any community living under complete state terror, under poverty, under helicopters flying over every single day, living under colonial terror day by day, will resist and has a right to resist. It has a right to resist. Even elephants resist brutality. And, you know, I mean, when an elephant kills the trainer, they don't question the elephant. They look at what the conditions are. They look at what the conditions are, what are forced on the situation. And I can tell you something, that the conditions in the Oakland Zoo for the animals, and it's very brutal. I don't support zoos because animals have a right to roam on their land for thousands of miles as, you know, as they need it. But there are people, animals in the Oakland Zoo can live in conditions that are better than African people live in Oakland, that do not have three meals a day, do not have a place to stay, that live under police terror every single day. And it's important that we say this because the question of the state is so important. It is not a question of a couple of bad cops. Because as the chairman said, even, you know, the bad cops, the good cops are the bad cops. You know, they're doing what they're supposed to do. But it's about, of course, the police have families, whatever. But they come into the African community as occupiers, as a military force to control and colonize the people. And we have to take a stand to end that police terror, to end that state violence, and to say, just like we would support, I certainly would, any child in Palestine that would kill an Israeli occupier with a rock, I would support the resistance of African people. But what the Uhuru movement is working for is organized resistance for the liberation of African people all around the world. Charity movements uphold white power and African dependence. They don't solve the problem. Saving the environment is only possible through the struggles for national liberation. The solution for the environment is to overturn the parasitic system built on slavery, built on genocide. There is no separation of that. And I can promise you, no matter how much you could make the Obama administration or some other administration around the world vote in laws to change it, it is never going to change it. Because imperialism and parasitic capitalism is about a profit motive. That is all it's about. It is not about the people. It is not about the earth. It is about plunder and rape and take everything you can and use it and sell it and make it into a commodity. So the national liberation of oppressed and colonized people is the only way out. It is the only solution. It is the land of the people, of the indigenous people in this case. It is their land. It is their struggle for national liberation. African people worldwide are uniting to liberate Africa. It belongs to them. Diamonds don't belong to De Beers. Oil doesn't belong to Shell in Africa, in Nigeria. It belongs to African people. The borders in Africa were set up by Europeans to facilitate the plunder and the enslavement of Africa. So what the Uhuru movement, the African Socialist International, is working for is to get rid of those borders, to tear them down, to unite Africa as one people all around the world. The diamonds in Africa belong to Africans. Why should we be talking about blood diamonds and whatever? All diamonds are blood diamonds. All diamonds are blood diamonds. A diamond worker in Sierra Leone, which is so abundant with diamonds, makes 30 cents a day on their own land. So with the control of their land and resources, liberated peoples will undo the deadly legacy of imperialist destruction. Again, the Uhuru movement is building the African Socialist International to unite African people everywhere, carrying on the legacy of Marcus Garvey, of Malcolm X, of Patrice Lumumba, Kwame Nkrumah. Africa's resources belong to African people everywhere. The Uhuru movement is building the All African People's Development and Empowerment Programs, African people, civil engineers, and farmers, and healthcare workers from all around the world coming together in Africa and even in the United States and African communities to unite the people, African people, to solve the problems, to begin building a liberated territory, an economy that serves the people, the interests of the people and by the people. African Village Survival Initiative, we'll be talking a lot more about that. That's in this country and around the world, community gardening, rainwater harvesting, sustainable programs in the context of the liberation of African people and oppressed people. For us, there is no future in this system as it is. There is a future for us, and it's in solidarity with the majority of humanity. That's the only way. We can't continue to separate ourselves out from everybody else. We have lived on the pedestal of the oppression of African and people around the world. We have. That's how we have 50% of the world's resources. That doesn't come because the people are all over the world are giving them to us. It's because the U.S. is sending guns and bombs and all kinds of insidious violence towards oppressed people everywhere so that we can live the lifestyle that we do. And we have to understand that. And it's not, You know, it isn't that we focus on guilt or something. We have to tell the truth. We have to look at what is creating the crisis of the world today and what will solve it. And do we want to stand on a pedestal that's being shaken up and overturned by everybody else and go down with the likes of Cheney and the Wall Street CEOs? And you know, these guys are committing suicide. You know, or, and if they aren't, they need to be. We reject complicity in a system that destroys humanity and destroys the earth. And we have to be organized, though. We have to be organized. We can't say, wow, I heard O'Malley Chatelas speak, and he was so dynamic, and now I can sit in the cafe with my latte and discuss these new ideas. You know, it's not just... of course we have to understand it. We do want to discuss it. But we have to be organized. It's absolutely what we have to do, because the state and all its violence is organized. It has organization and money and guns. Yeah. Oppressed people have organization, and we can be part of that by being organized under the leadership of this movement for liberation. And the Uhuru movement, you know, if Africa can be liberated, and it will be in our lifetime, because it is building, this organization is building throughout Africa and wherever African people are. And we will see this more as a clear expression of what the future of this planet can be. The genie will not go back in the bottle. The times are changing, and people all over the planet can be in dire poverty in the middle of a desert, but still see, you know, the internet. They see where the resources are. Oh, that's where our diamonds are. Well, we want it for our kids. We want our children to grow up. There's not going to be oil for the SUVs of America when the people of Africa are starving and, you know, polluted to death by all of these parasitic corporations and entities that are there so that they can maintain the lifestyle. And you can look at the economic crisis, and what is Obama trying to do? Because Obama is a neocolonialist, and I'm sure that the chairman will talk about that. He's there to protect the system. He's there as a result of this crisis, as the chairman says. But what is he trying to do? He's trying to re-spark the consumer society that has, you know, been very instrumental in creating the situation that exists now, that has heightened the crisis. He's not creating a new kind of economy. He's not going to. He can't do that. He's beholden to capitalism and imperialism. So we have to join Uhuru Solidarity Movement. We have to take a stand. This is Comrade Ruby. Back in the day when the Uhuru Movement was building for the whole question of homelessness in Oakland and giving power and organizing homeless African people in their parks and setting up 10 cities before it was popular and happened all over the world. She took a stand. She went to jail, and she was very courageous. We have to do that. We have to be out there on the front lines, demonstrating in the white community, at the police stations, taking a stand in solidarity with the struggle for African people. And the Solidarity Movement was created in 1976. Had March Against Genocide, building Uhuru Foods, raising resources in solidarity. We do very politicized food booths in Gay Pride Day in California and Monterey Jazz and places, you know, all over Northern California. We're known. We've been doing that since late 1970s. So, you know, we're kind of very, very well known there. And the Stop the War Against the African Community, this is part of what the Solidarity Movement, the stand that it's taken, a march against genocide, a stand against the police terror, the public policies of police containment against the African community. So we're saying, if you want to change the world, and we have to change the world, we don't have the luxury anymore to sit around and not do something. We don't have that luxury, because the world is in such a deep flux and deep crisis that we have to be able to be sure that we're on the right side, that comes out of this in a positive way for all of humanity. It needs all of us. as few as we are in this room right now, we can influence and win so many others. Every question can be taken on through this analysis, whether we're talking about what it means to be a woman, what it means to be gay, lesbian, and gender issues. Any issue we can talk about through the eyes of the African working class. We want to be part of a society in which there are no oppressors and the oppressed, in which there are no exploitation of anyone, because everyone should have the ability to live in a positive way in this society, which we don't have. I don't want to live in a society that, you know, only my family can eat because Africans are starving or have to go to jail and prison instead of going to college or having a job in this country. I don't want to live that. That's why, you know, what, 50, 70% of North Americans are taking Xanax and Prozac and all that. It's the largest selling legal drug in the United States. To forget. But we have to look at it. We have to look at the truth. And we have to say we don't want to live in a society that's based on that. We want to be part of creating a new world that has to come about right now. So we say, Uhuru, one Africa, one nation.
Uhuru, and that was African People's Solidarity Committee Chairwoman Penny Hess speaking yesterday on May 2nd at the National Conference of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement. And it was, for those of you that were able to attend, I know it was a tremendous conference with speeches by African People's Socialist Party Chairman Amalia Shatella, African People's Solidarity Committee Chairwoman Penny Hess, and many other workshops, both theoretical and practical. And if you missed it, you should, in any case, get involved with the Uhuru Solidarity Movement. You can go online and find us at uhurusolidarity.org. That's uhurusolidarity.org. Get involved, join the movement, take a stand in solidarity with African liberation struggle. There are ongoing events coming up that you can be a part of. You can find all that information on the site. And you can contact us. Our contact information is on that site as well. So we want to thank you for joining us today on Solidarity, Not Charity. Oh, we will be back again next week. This concludes our broadcast. This also concludes the Sunday broadcast of UhuruRadio.com, the international voice of the African Revolution. Uhuru.